So I am my talk today is going to be divided into three topics. So first we are going to discuss what an animal model is. Then we're going to go over how to select the right model for the type of research that you're going to be doing. And then the process of using animals for research, testing, and teaching at Roswell Park. So now that you've seen the facility, you have a good idea of the standards that we like to keep. There are different steps to using animals in research, so we will go over those as well. So first of all, types of animal models. So I know that from the paper that you read ahead of time, you realize that it's always recommended to the researchers to do in vitro studies as much as possible. The data that they can gather with in vitro models, computerized models, it's important. Sometimes they can do a lot of things in media, in the lab setting, until they're ready to move to animal models. So animal model analog process, they could model analog process. So these are the ones that relate to one structure process to another. So when you want to compare one specific thing, one to another. Or homologous, that will sometimes reflect the counterpart that you're wanting to assess. And there are a lot of new technologies like genetic sequencing that you can actually compare and do the homologous characterization of your models. Genetically engineered mice, or GM mice, it's a common term used. You now know, again, we have a transgenic facility here at the Institute. They can meet with the researchers to really target a gene of interest. This gene can be either knocked in or knocked out of your models, so then you can engineerly create a mouse model to study specifically any pathways or any characterizations that you need. So this genetically engineered mice are the primary driver of this homologous modeling that we were talking before. And again, a rapid genomic sequencing and genomic manipulation really has improved how much data you can collect and how fast you can collect it. Now, there are two different types of modeling concepts. One is the one-to-one modeling and the many-to-many modeling. The one-to-one modeling is pursued generally to demonstrate a similar phenotype. And then the many-to-many is a result from that it's a component of several levels. For example, a system or an organ, and you can go all the way down to the cellular level. So the most common modeling concept used is the many-to-many. And because the diseases like cancer they're so complex that you really need to assess different physiological parameters, many-to-many resources. We also have another classification that could be spontaneous versus induced animal models. So there are some spontaneous animal models that they will have phenotypic similarities to those of humans, or that they are abnormal members of the species that arise through spontaneous mutations. And I'll give you some examples of that. And then we have induced models that you can actually create either surgically. You can do genetic backcrossing. Someone was asking about the breeding. And so you can actually backcross, do a genetic manipulation to enhance one of these spontaneous models. Not spontaneous, but generate the model. And then you can also use chemicals or other type of manipulations that will alter that normal physiological state to create your model. So here are some examples of spontaneous mutations. So the gun rat is a common animal model that is used to study hereditary hyperbilirubinemia. These rats, you have to really monitor them when they're born, because they will be yellow or jaundiced before they have any hair, and you would be able to determine which ones are the ones that have the genes that are usually transmitted as an autosomal recessive characteristic. And so then when you really look carefully, once they start growing hair, you really have to focus on the mucous membranes, like the ears, to determine which ones are the ones that have the characteristic of the mutation. More common to us are the non-obese diabetic mice or the BB Wurstar rats. These are spontaneous models of type 1 diabetes. And there's a lot of research being done with this mice, and some of them here at the Institute as well. You saw today our colony of SCID mice. These are the severely immunodeficient animals. These animals are used for patient-derived xenografts. They do not reject these tumors. And then there's a lot of experiments that can be done in them. They're a very valuable model. Because they are severely immune compromised, it's important to keep in mind that you have to be very careful to not introduce any pathogens, because they can get sick very easily since they don't have either B cells or T cells. Another mutation, and it disrupts the FOXN1 gene, it's the nude mouse. And these animals don't have any hair, and they do not have a thymus either. So they are T deficient, very also commonly used for generating tumor studies. You can do cell lines in them, or you can surgically inoculate them. There's a lot of people, like I was mentioning to the group that went with me, they're doing a lot of orthotopic implantation of the tumors. So they collect the tumors in the tissue of origin, like if it's a pancreatic tumor, and then they go and do the surgery in the mouse to put that tumor in the mouse pancreas too. So it's a very commonly used model. It also requires special care to make sure to not introduce any pathogens again, because they are immunodeficient. These are examples of other spontaneous models. In this facility and in our institute, the majority of the animals that we use are mice, as you saw. We do have the woodchuck colony for liver cancer, but that is a spontaneous, well, it is actually created because we do have to infect the pups with the woodchuck hepatitis virus. But these are spontaneous models, and in other facilities and in other institutions where they house this kind of animals, you can study these different spontaneous models. So now looking at the induced models. So these models really have revolutionized throughout history. You know, surgical models really helped with organ transplantation. Nowadays, they do it so often in humans, and they really started doing it in animals to make sure that they were able to do that. Here are other examples of induced models that have used animals to perfect and refine the techniques that are nowadays used in humans. Also, the discovery of insulin was done in dogs, and nowadays they're even improving for people that have type 1 diabetes that require insulin to live, and they're doing a lot more research in that sense, so they don't have to, you know, inject themselves. They're doing different pumps, they're doing different drugs that will help with that. Just continuing with some other examples of induced models, we can do by diet administration or chemical administration. The common model, I'm sure some of you have heard about, the streptozotocin, which induces diabetes, because these drugs really, you give one IP injection to the rats and it destroys the beta cells of their pancreas, and the very next day really the animals have type 1 diabetes. So you can induce the model chemically. There is a lot of chemical mutagenesis being done at a more molecular level, if you will, in zebrafish, commonly used. We had one researcher here at the Institute using zebrafish, but he no longer does that. It's a very interesting animal model. There are facilities that have thousands of zebrafish, and they can do these point mutations and chemical mutagenesis. And then, of course, the diet-induced models. There's a lot of vitamin D studies being done here. At the Institute, there's been a lot of discoveries of vitamins and many other diseases using diet-induced models. So now we're talking about the humanized SCIDs, which you already saw. Usually there are investigators that either purchase these animals commercially available from Jackson Laboratories. They are NSG mice, and they can bring them here. They can have approval to do some breeding, maintaining some breeding colony to do some of their experiments. But they are specifically used, again, for PDX modeling, and they are very delicate, even a little bit more than the skids. And we need to change them religiously once a week because they can even get infections from their own feces, believe it or not. So they are a very promising model. They have been developed for the personalized medicine and personalized cancer treatments that you hear nowadays. You can do transplanting tissue biopsies directly from the patients. There is a bank here at the Institute, and there are approvals for our researchers to receive some of these patient samples, and then they use them directly in this model. All right, so that was a little bit about the types of models that are there for you, and if in the future, probably near future, you're going to be doing some of your own research, I do encourage you to look at the resources. It's incredible the amount of resources available, so you can select the best animal model for the type of studies that you need. So the process of using animals for research, teaching, and testing. So laboratory animal science professionals, and I consider myself one of those, we do accept the responsibility for caring up for the animals. So we obviously want to support the quality of the research that you are going to be performing, and we need to comply with all of these regulatory requirements that we have to abide. We also use these animals in research, and we consider it a privilege, and as such, it's important to follow the rules and regulations because these privileges can be removed. So it's important that you accept this responsibility when working with animals in research. So there are a few bodies that we have to work with, and internally, every institute by law is required to have an Institute Animal Care and Use Committee, or what you normally know as IACUC. Here at the Institute, our IACUC is very involved. We really try to help the researchers. We try to refine the techniques. We try to advise them in the best models and procedures. So it's important that you understand that they're here to help and not to be, a hindering in your experiments. So the IACUC has a lot of responsibilities, and the most common that you would hear is that they meet. I am part of the IACUC too, because again, by law, a veterinarian needs to be a member of the committee. We meet the first Tuesday of every month, and we review the new proposals from the research body or the research investigators that want to use animals in research. So we, as IACUC member, one of the functions is to approve these protocols that have been submitted by the researchers or principal investigators. One of the other basic functions of the IACUC is to monitor the care and use program here at the Institute and also the facility. So not only do they review our program, so that includes the teaching that we do, the care that we provide the animals, the teaching that we provide and training to our own staff to make sure that they properly take care of the animals, but they also inspect the facility. So we need to maintain the facility as you saw it today, free of debris on the floor. We not only take care of the microenvironment, but also the macroenvironment. Even though we move a lot of racks and things, we have to protect the walls because anything that can get scratched or scraped can grow bacteria, and we don't want that. So they do monitor the program and the facilities twice a year. And in another sense, the IACUC also protects not only the investigators and the institution, but they also inspire confidence to the public to make sure that they reassure people out there that we are doing research in a humane and proper manner. So again, to reiterate that research is a privilege and not a right, and people out there really sometimes don't agree in using animals at all, in less in research. So that's why it's important that you understand that by following all these rules, we are assuring the public that we are doing it humanely and following all the regulatory requirements. So moving a little bit away from the internal body that oversees how we do research, there are other laws and guidelines that govern the animal research in the United States. And those are the USDA, which is the United States Department of Agriculture, and they endorse this act. This is the Animal Welfare Act, and it has really detailed characteristics and really detailed responsibilities for any research or any animal use for either teaching, training, or doing research. So we do follow the USDA guidelines. So which animals are covered by USDA? So again, since USDA follows the Animal Welfare Act, they regulate institutions that fit the following criteria. So sometimes people purchase or transfer live animals in commerce or receive funds under a grant, award, loan, or contract from a department or agency of the United States for the purpose of carrying out research tests or experiments. So obviously all of you that are working with any researchers, you know that they have to write grants, NIH or CDC. Once they get this funds, then we fall under this category. So to what animals do the animal welfare regulations apply? So there are different definitions of animal depending on the regulation. So for USDA, this is the definition of animal. And if you notice, they exclude mice and rats and birds. They also exclude horses that are not used for research. So to the USDA, research animals are all except mice, rats, and horses. So for us, mice and rats are not covered by USDA, but our woodchucks, rabbits, pigs are covered by USDA. So we have to comply with that regulatory body. So who takes care of covering the research in mice and rats? That is the Public Health Service policy, or PHS policy. So it's a very important agency, and it's involved in regulating animal use, and it is from the Department of Health and Human Services, and that is the home of the PHS policy. The PHS policy also it has to be in compliance with OLA, which is the Office of Lab Animal Welfare, and they do give a assurance number to facilities that use mice and rats in research. So again, here at the Institute, we have to comply with both because we have both USDA animals and mice and rats. So we comply with both OLA and PHS and USDA. Now, USDA in the Office of Lab Animal Welfare, they endorse the guide. We usually refer to it as the guide, but it's the guide for the care and use of laboratory animals. It's like a Bible for research institutions. We have to follow everything that is in this document. They do go from facilities, how we need to maintain the air handling changes. Like, for example, in this facility, we keep 10 to 15 air changes in each room per hour. We need to comply with the lighting, the ventilation, the airlocks that you saw today. All of this is described here in detail, and we have to comply with the guide. So this is the definition of animal as per PHS policy. So it does include mice and rats, as I mentioned. And now we also voluntarily apply to be ALAC accredited. ALAC International is known now, is the Association for the Assessment and Accreditation of Laboratory Animal Care. And when you write a grant, they usually will ask you if the facility where you are doing your research is ALAC accredited. So what that means is that we really maintain the gold standards of animal care, and we have to comply with a lot of things. We are actually preparing right now for our site visit. It's every 3 years, and we submit a program description in detail explaining everything we do here. How we train people, how many times a week the cages are changed, the temperatures of the water, every single detail of what we do, the veterinary program, how do we take care of the animals, and then we submit that program description, and then they come and do the site visit, usually 2 days for the size of our facilities. So we're very proud of this ALAC accreditation. All right, just wanted to know if you are with me. So which organization is responsible for monitoring institutions complying with PHS policy? Is this the CDC, the Animal and Plant Office of Lab Animal Welfare, or Fish and Wildlife? Very good. It's three, OLA. Mice of the genus Mus and rats of the genus Rattus used in research are covered by?
Two.
PHS. Very good. All right, so talking a little bit more about doing research here at the Institute. So if you're planning to use experiments that use animals, how do you get started? You know, how do you begin? So you have to explain why you need to use animals in research and why is it important for you to use animals. So again, you probably would have to say, I already did a lot of in vitro and now I do require the intrinsic, you know, physiological characteristics to be able to move on in my research. So it's very important that you describe the reason why you need to use live animals. The iACUC application here has very specific questions, and sometimes it's easier to complete it if you start by answering those questions. And some of those questions will say, how will the proposed use of animals improve the health of other people or animals? So if you can think about those things, it'll be easier to fill your form. The experimental design is very important. So keep in mind that you not only need to use the right model, but you need to use the right number of animals. You need to determine when you are going to have your scientific endpoint and your humane endpoint. So all of these in your study design is very important. So keep in mind that in general, there must be a compelling potential for benefit of human or animal health to really warrant the use of animals. One of the members of the IACUC committee is a non-scientist. So it is important that when you're submitting your IACUC application that you use lay terms. You know, try to prevent using the scientific jargon because one of the members is a member of the community. For example, here at Roswell, we have two IACUC members. One of them was a librarian and one of them was a teacher. And so even though they are very intelligent people, they do need to understand in lay terms what is it that you're proposing. So if you have any medical terms or if you have any acronyms, it's important to define them at the beginning of your application and then you can use them at the rest. So again, the animal models that you're going to use are very important to consider in your experimental design. So keep in mind that the IACUC needs to understand the proposed use of the animals. Sometimes it's recommended to use flowcharts to explain your experimental design in a little more clear manner. You have to also justify the animal model that you finally selected. So if you're going to be studying or doing research here at the Institute, most likely you're going to be justifying the need to use immune-compromised animals because you need to study some of the tumor growth and things like that. If there is, it's important to do your homework. So if there are papers that reference a little bit about the work that you're interested in, make sure that previous work in biomedical literature can be validated, but do not repeat what others have done. You know, so you can use that as reference to help you answer part of your question and your hypotheses from what other people are doing. And then they, once you publish, they might look after what you're done to complement, you know, the advancements. Always important to determine the number of groups that you're going to use. Keep in mind that when you do research with mice, you usually are going to be needing groups of animals. Animals that will be your control, animals that will be on your high dose, low dose, something like that. So it's important that you determine the correct number of animals that you're going to use so you have good statistical significance and that they are available from commercial vendors. Cost alone is not a good reason to use mice. Oh, I'm going to use mice because they're cheap. That's not a good reason to use cost as an only reason. Also, it's important to know if there are antibodies, reagents, things that you need to really do your your analysis of the data that you collect. So if there are no antibodies available there, it might be difficult to do that line of research. So make sure that you have the tools for that species that you select for your research. As I was saying, a statistical analysis is very recommended. So there are statistics department here at the Institute. You can meet with them and they will tell you how many animals you can use for your research. Keep in mind that the IACUC protocols are good for 3 years. Sometimes the grants are divided in different aims per year, so you can determine how many animals you will need the first year. And so at the end of 3 years, you might have used 3,000 animals or 300, but the statistics group will tell you how many animals you should use to get that data and make it statistically significant. Now, keep in mind that it's perfectly okay to ask the IACUC to do a pilot study or to do some extra animals to practice your technique. If you're going to be doing a very, very delicate surgical procedure, it's okay to practice, and you can use some of your approved animals in your protocol with all the procedures that you want to do in the actual experimental protocol to practice. So it's important that you understand that that is perfectly okay. Or if you're not very sure, you did not find a lot of, let's say what you want to do is novel. There's not a lot of references out there. So usually it's a good idea to start with a pilot study. So you start with a smaller number, analyze that data, and then report back and said, we got great preliminary information, and now we want to expand to a larger group of animals. So that's proper for IACUC to approve that. Now, you need to describe in detail the procedure. So they have to include any non-surgical things that you're going to do. So if you're just going to inject the animals, you're going to weigh them, you're going to measure tumors, these are non-surgical approaches. You have to also describe in detail what routes of injection you're going to use, if you are going to be delivering any drug. And all of this we will teach you in a wet lab that you will receive once you start working with animals. If you have surgical methods, remember in your protocol to include that you're going to use aseptic technique, that you're going to use good refinement, you know, you're going to use anesthesia, and more importantly, analgesia. You're always going to be taking care of relieving any pain or distress for the animals that you use in research. All right, so which of the following is helpful for the IACUC when reviewing an animal protocol? Is it good to use a lot of abbreviations and jargon? Probably not. Highly technical language? No. A description of proposed procedures on the animal protocol that require reviewer to refer back to other documents? Or the last one? The last one. So use a flow chart or, you know, to illustrate. So try not to be complicated in the protocol. Some people like to copy and paste from the grants, and the grants are very, very scientific and technical. It really doesn't go well in the IACUC. It's better to be, you know, short and clear in your IACUC protocol. Which of the following is false? So which species should be used instead of invertebrates whenever possible? Vertebrates? Dogs are higher in the species of the hierarchy? Are dogs higher than rabbits? That's a yes. So the first one is wrong. We should always try to use models and invertebrates before using animals. Okay, so if there's something that I want you to take home today, is the concept of the 3 R's in research. So Russell and Birch were two scientists, and they thought that it would be very important to always try to replace the use of animals, if you can, with models. Try to reduce the number of animals if you have a good statistical analysis, and try to refine your techniques as much as possible. So think about the 3 R's of research whenever you're either writing a protocol or when you're thinking about doing animal research. So the purpose of this concept really is to minimize animal use, to minimize their pain or distress, and still achieving critical scientific objectives for your, you know, endeavors and in the advancements of health and medicine. So some examples of replacement. I think I've said already this. So we can use computer models, cell cultures, or in vitro assays. Practical examples of replacements, some of these. Use of cell culture techniques to replace animal incubators for cell lines. Use of immunological bench assays to replace bioassays. And of course, computer software that nowadays is so advanced. The second R is reduction, and that really is simply the number of animals used. So using the appropriate group sizes to obtain statistical significance is important, and it complies with one of the three R's. Performing multiple experiments simultaneously, so you can use the same control group. That will help you reduce a little bit the number of animals. If you can share tissues with other investigators so that additional animals are not needed, sometimes you can. So that's why it's important to also attend some of the lectures being given at the Institute so you see what your colleagues or what the other people are doing. And sometimes you wouldn't believe the number of times that collaborations get initiated from this lectures that you attend. Designing experiments so that animals serve as their own control when it's scientifically appropriate, that can be done. And using newer instrumentation that improves the precision and reduces the number of animals, also it's another example of reduction. And then the last R is refinement. So it refers to changing experiments or procedures to reduce pain or distress in those animals that must be used. So examples, like if you use new anesthetics, not long ago, a lot of people would prefer to use injectable anesthetics for their mice to do their procedures. And now we've moved to doing isoflurane delivered with oxygen. The person providing the anesthesia is in total control because the animals recover so much faster. So it is a refinement. It really is. New analgesics. So now there are analgesics that have longer acting action, so you don't have to provide them that often. You can just provide once, and every 10 hours, if the animal is showing any signs of pain, then you can repeat it instead of every hour. So again, some of the refinements. New bleeding and injection techniques. So again, before, a lot of the people were used to collecting blood samples from the sinus that the mice have behind their eyes. Now there are newer techniques that can allow you to collect good blood samples from the mandibular vein. The animal doesn't need to be anesthetized and doesn't affect their eyes. So some of these improved techniques really are a part of a refinement. Improved surgical techniques. Again, I always say to people, make sure you practice the technique, make sure you refine your technique, use the right instruments, use smaller incisions. All of that is refinement. And then also you check with the literature or with us here at the Institute. The veterinary services team really have a lot of experience and we can help you refine your techniques. Another important aspect of writing protocols and doing animal research is to consider alternatives. So the animal welfare regulations require that the IACUC do other two things regarding alternatives. To ensure that the PIs consider alternatives for painful and distressing procedures, and also to evaluate a written narrative describing sources where that they use to determine that there are alternatives available. So reducing pain and distress and alternatives. So you definitely have checked that there are no alternatives to what you're proposing to do. There are a lot of organizations out there and websites that will help you find alternatives. You use keywords that might be relevant to the experiments that you want. You enter them in this websites, and they will bring papers so you can see what other people are doing that is related to what you want to do. Pain categories. So the pain categories are commonly recommended even if you don't use USDA regulated species. So even though mice and rats are not USDA regulated, we still like to use what is called a pain category used by USDA. So it goes from B, C, D, and E. I really don't know why they don't start with A, but they don't. I guess B starts with breeding. So breeding is non-painful or distressful. And then C would be considered a momentarily pain, like if you do an injection to an animal, a sub-Q, it's a momentarily pain that the animal can withstand. D is any procedure in which you're going to relieve pain or distress. So if you're going to provide anesthesia or analgesics, immediately falls on category D. Very rare do we have here in the facility or in our institute any E categories, which is unrelieved pain. There are for other institutions where they study pain management and things like that, where they cannot alleviate pain because it contraindicates what they're trying to study. Here in the institute, we always, it has to be really, really justifiable to not do, to not unrelieve pain or distress for IACUC to approve it. So that I can remember, we probably had one and no longer being done. This is something that I always tell people when they say, should I use analgesics for this? So always think of a procedure that would cause pain or distress in a human. So if sometimes people say, I'm just going to do a little cut under the skin, put the tumor, done. Do I need to use pain or just, analgesics? So I say, okay, would that hurt you if someone cut just a little bit? Yes, it would. So anything that could cause pain or distress to a human could cause pain or distress to an animal. The endpoint criteria is very important too. So think about the scientific endpoint. And this is where we always try to work with the researchers to find the middle ground. You know, PIs always try, not always, but some PIs push the limit in when is my endpoint. I have not gathered the information I need even though the animal looks really sick. So that is important to really have clear in your head what is your endpoint. The humane endpoint and the scientific endpoint. So, some of the endpoints might require to euthanize an animal to prevent it from suffering. So as I was showing a group that walked with me, once the tumor in a mouse reaches that 2 by 2 centimeter, even though the mouse is moving okay, it is an endpoint for that mouse. You cannot allow that tumor to grow any bigger because it's going to start getting ulcerated and affecting the health of the animal. So you have to also think about anything that is causing pain to the animal. So if you are restraining an animal to do something and it's causing him distress and pain, then you should realize that you probably need anesthesia instead of just, you know, trying to make sure that you relieve that distress. Or simply remove the animal from the study. It's one of the other endpoints. So common examples of endpoints, weight loss. So sometimes you start an experiment and the animals start losing weight too much. So make sure that you start with a baseline. And once you reach that percentage, then that is an endpoint that you remove the animal from that study. Sudden pain of distress that cannot be alleviated with analgesics. It's another example. Or a severe medical condition that cannot be controlled with therapy. So here at Roswell, we have tumor size as an endpoint. I already said it. In mice, it's 2 by 2 centimeters. If it is in the skin, there's a lot of PIs using internal tumors. So if you don't have the ability to image to determine the size of the tumor internally, then you have to use a scoring criteria, like a scoring system, because how else are you going to monitor the size of the tumor? So here at Roswell, we do have imaging capabilities to follow the growth of the tumors. And once they reach certain size, that is your scientific endpoint and human endpoint. So surgery is another section in the protocol, and it will be addressed in detail in the protocol. But it will require an additional wet lab so we can go with you on principles of rodent surgery. But some of the things that you can always think about is general anesthesia versus regional anesthesia, depending on the type of procedure, if it's a minor versus a major procedure. But it's a lot easier to just anesthetize the mouse in the induction chamber that you saw throughout the facility. It is less stressful for you and less stressful for the animal. This is a classification of surgery. There is survival versus non-survival. Survival surgery is the one in which the animal will regain consciousness from anesthesia. So there is a must here. You have to always use sterile techniques. You have to prevent post-operative infections. And then you have to make sure that the incision site is properly prepared. You know, you clip the hair, disinfect. All of those are musts in survival surgeries. Non-survival is the one that the animal will not wake up after the surgery, so you don't have to use sterile technique, but you still have to use gloves and clean instruments. And what is still a must is to make sure that the animal has reached the plane of anesthesia before you do your technique, even though the animal is not going to regain consciousness, but it is a must. The other classification is major versus minor. Major surgery is one that penetrates or exposes a body cavity or that causes a major physiological impairment. So if you're going to open the abdomen or if you are going to amputate a leg, causes major physiological impairment, so it's considered a major surgery, requires analgesic. Minor surgery is less invasive. The example I gave of doing a cut under the skin to put a piece of tumor, or if you're going to cannulate a vessel, those are considered minor. So here in the facility, you saw it already, so I won't take too long on this. We're done here. But the rooms designated for surgery can vary depending on the species, of course. You saw that we have our nice ORs that we can use for large animals or USDA-regulated species. For mice and rats, you can use the biosafety cabinet, and you will set up your isoflurane machine like that. Or you can use the biobubbles up on the third floor if you need to do the microscope. This is always a must. You always have to anesthetize and provide pain medication to animals that are going to go under surgery. So I always like to tell people that it's better to prevent the pain than to treat it. So you can give the analgesics and hydration to the animal before you even do your incisions. So the animal will be preventing that pain before it even occurs. Also, if you are a great surgeon and you do beautiful and then you forget that there is post-op care, then it won't be as successful. So always keep in mind that the animal needs to be seen to see if it requires a little more pain medication, to make sure that the incision is intact, to make sure that the animal regained the normal activity of eating and drinking, to make sure that it was successful. For post-op, also for regulatory requirements, documentation is key, and also for your own experimental data. So make sure that you keep track of the IDs of the animals, that you document the days that you inoculated the tumors, when they started growing. All of that documentation is very important. For USDA animals, when we get our inspections, they always ask for medical records. They always ask for IACUC protocols. So we usually keep those here in our facility. Just a few other details in regards to collecting blood samples from small animals like mice and rats. It's important to think about how much volume can I safely collect from a small animal. So usually the rule of thumb is 1% of their body weight. An adult 6 to 8 week old mouse usually weighs 20 grams. So usually you can collect 0.2 mLs of blood, and you have to wait until the blood replenishes again. So usually 2 or 3 weeks. If you need to collect more often, then you need to reduce the volume. And now that the technology has advanced so much, you really need a few drops of blood to be able to analyze your data, so it's very easy to collect those samples. I was telling you about the refinement, so now we don't go behind the eye, we do the mandibular, and it's very easy to do. The white mice have like a little swirl of hair right there where you need to just poke using either a needle or one of those lancets that people use to get a... And so you can do the lancet, and immediately you can collect your blood sample. As soon as you release and put a little pressure, it stops. Now, in your protocol, you have to write the name of the people that are going to do the procedure. So it's important that the experience and training is documented and that you can write it in there. Any academic degrees that the person performing the procedures have, it's important. But it is important, you know, it's not important by itself, but it is important in evaluating the research being done. So, use of hazardous and toxic agents in animals. Again, with the group that went with me, I showed you the importance of labeling the cages when you start an experiment that uses a biohazard, so it protects everybody, not only you, but the people cleaning the cages. And then it's important to get the training to make sure that if you have a radioactive substance or a toxic chemical, that you let everybody know that you're introducing those into your animals. And lastly, euthanasia, which literally means good death. I was saying that we owe all the respect to these research animals that provide so much for us. So we need to make sure that we are trained in the proper techniques of humanely euthanizing the animals. We need to ensure that there is a rapid loss of consciousness followed by cardiac or respiratory arrest, and then finally brain function. So if we ensure this, there would be no suffering, no distress to the animals. They will lose consciousness before any of the other ensue to create euthanasia. And it is necessary to euthanize most of our animals because we need to collect data, we need to analyze tissues, so that's why it's important that you specify in the protocols. There is a law that was passed last year by Governor Cuomo, and it's for those institutions that use dogs and cats in research. They have asked the institutions to create a policy to assess the option for adoption of dogs or cats that are used in research. Sometimes the dogs that served as the control don't need to be euthanized to collect tissues or whatever. And so sometimes those dogs can be sent for adoption. So we do have a policy in the rare case that we have a dog protocol. So we just wanted you to share that with you, that we do try to see if the dogs can be adopted. So the training is important. There are different methods of euthanasia, so it's important to emphasize what you need to do. Sometimes people say, I cannot have CO2 because it will damage the architecture of the tissue I need. So there are other methods of euthanasia that we can teach you and you can learn. All of these need to be approved by IACUC. Make sure that that is the case. Amendments are also okay. So let's say you start a protocol and you need to change something. So make sure you get an amendment approved before doing the changes in the animal. So, and again, our IACUC works really fast. If you need to do it fast, they will process it depending on the amendment. If it's something minor that you just need to change, if it's something that requires full committee, it'll wait until the next month. But if it's something small, the amendments are okay to submit it however many times you need. And then at the 3 years, you just renew the protocol and include any of the amendments that you had approved. Some of the services here, again, we do provide the training. We oversee and provide the care to your animals, and we do the health surveillance with our sentinel just to make sure that we can tell you that your animals are free of any diseases and that the data that you're collecting is reliable. The housing that you saw provides bioprotection, biocontainment, and bioexclusion. It's a microvent, microflow, active system. So the ventilated cages are docked into the racks, and they are provided with HEPA filter. The air comes in the cage and then constantly comes out because the top is not sealed. It allows for the air to constantly come out, so nothing goes in the cage. Once this air comes out, then it gets exhausted through the outside. And this is what you saw today in our facility, the type of housing, the number of cages, the number of rooms that we have. There's some additional training that you might need for restraining animals, how to hold them. We will teach you all that in our wet lab that we give. Some of the common procedures, sexing the animals. So at 21 days, when you need to wean the pups, you need to sex them because you need to separate males and females. And it's usually done by the anogenital distance. So the males have a larger distance than the females. It's a lot harder to do in the little tiny pups, but once you start doing it often, you'll get very good at it and comfortable. Animal identification, there is a universal ear punching system that you can use. Some other people are using the tattooing. I've done it. It works very well. There is one controversial method of identification that it has to be justified to be approved, and it's the toe clipping on the little tiny pups. Sometimes pups die early for any genetic mutation that they might have, but they need to be identified since 2 days of age. So they do cut the tips of the toes. I don't like that, but we can do any type of identification that you need. Common routes of drug administration. In mice, subcutaneous, IP, and intravenous. Usually mice don't have a lot of muscle, so intramuscular is not a common route. Gavage, you actually use these gavage needles that have this ball on the tip, and you can deliver the drug directly into the stomach of the mouse every single time. You all saw our woodchuck colony at Roswell. Again, it's the animal model for liver cancer. We use the mailbox to handle them. They seem to be pretty content here. They are healthy. Our colony seems to be very healthy. The breeding goes well. There is a high mortality on the pups in the wild as well. And in captivity, there is high mortality. Then we infect the pups at 2 to 3 days of age. And then we test them throughout their first year to make sure that they are positive. And then those animals become very valuable, not only for antiviral studies, but also once they've developed the tumor, for anti-tumor studies. So significance of animal care, it provides reliable research and obviously animal welfare. So final comments. Animal research, it really is important. It has provided us with incredible advancements in medicine and also for our own animals. So by understanding more about animal research, you help your IACUC and the research community. We also ensure the public that it's being conducted well. And we need research in our society, so if you keep doing it correctly, we'll have no problem. So thank you for your attention, and I hope you got something out of today. Thank you.